Every great film and TV maker began as a red carpet rookie. In this podcast, each episode provides a new conversation with a leading film and TV industry professional, deconstructing their creative career and delving into the life lessons and stories they've picked up along the journey. My name is Mike Battle, a film crew member turned screenwriter, and I'll be your host, and this is Red Carpet Rookies.
I was 24 years old when we went over to make Schindler's List. I didn't know what I was doing.
I have that still. Everything I do, imposter syndrome.
What I learned from Steven Spielberg is
just keep going.
Push forward, you know, no matter how bad things get.
And then they casted a young guy named Brad Pitt.
Don't think so much.
Don't take no for an answer.
It was my first meeting with David about Fight Club.
The day that Pixar called, I was ready.
I just picked up the phone and made $500,000.
I mean, at the beginning of every job, I kind of think, what if I don't have any ideas?
Dream come true, working on a Bond film.
I was terrified because I thought, well, what if I just screw this right up?
He said, you'll get a script at the end of the week. It was Titanic.
I'm very excited to introduce today's guest, who cut his teeth working on the British children's TV that made up my childhood, with shows like The Queen's Nose, Tracy Beaker, and My Parents Are Aliens, before transitioning to his own creations like Fresh Meat, and most notably, the one and only The Great Peep Show, which he co-created with longtime collaborator Jesse Armstrong and won a BAFTA for. In the years since, he has had a lauded and varied career with work on projects including Chris Morris's incredible Category of One terrorism-based comedy Four Lions, material for The Thick of It, and more recently, even his own movies, such as Corporate Animals with Demi Moore and The Stand-In with Drew Barrymore. My guest is Sam Bain. How are you doing today?
Yeah, very good. Nice to be on the podcast. It's always nice to feel like you're doing something to help the new, young and terrified members of this industry.
Absolutely. And we very much thank you for it, Sam. Now, I ask all of my guests the same first question, and that is, what did your parents do, Sam? And did it affect your career choices moving forward?
Well, I come from a sort of comedy TV family. So my dad was, he died when I was quite young, but he was a TV drama director. He directed Upstairs, Downstairs, got an Emmy for that, The Avengers, other classic sort of shows from the 60s and 70s. And my mum was an actress, so she was in Terry and June, long-running mainstream sitcom in the late 70s, early 80s. And my grandmother was in Fawlty Towers. She's one of the old ladies, Miss wow. Gatsby. My granddad was quite a famous Jewish comedian, musical and radio comedian in like the 40s. I could go on. You know, it's quite a long list. But one thing I would say is that, you know, it didn't really occur to me how much that background had helped me until I was a few years into my career, because I never got a particular leg up. Like, you know, I never got like an introduction to my, you know, parents' agent or anything like that. No direct help, no sort of contact as such. But I think looking back, it was incredibly helpful growing up in a family where I was doing my childhood drawings in the backs of scripts or big camera plans, studio shows, because I was aware that you could make a good living in television. And that's what my dad was doing. And That is a piece of information that is not widely available to young people.
Yeah, I guess it's such a smoke and mirrors type industry to get on set at all, to know it's even there. And then often parents, even if they do know it's there, they're not necessarily being like, as you said, you can make a good living in it.
Yeah, I mean, my mum was always kind of nervous that I was going into writing because she knew how insecure it could be, but she's also supportive. But I just knew that there were jobs there, right? And so, knowing that, not really the conscious, I didn't think it through. I just knew it in my bones because I'd grown up in that household. Like, there are jobs there, and if there are jobs there, why can't I do one of them?
Did you spend much time on set as a kid running around?
Not a lot, but I had a very memorable trip to see my dad in the 70s. They don't really do it anymore, but studio drama was a big thing. A lot of dramas were shot in studios. And so I went, he was in the booth, the booth, which is sort of most famous in like news shows these days, but he was looking at down at the studio and upstairs, downstairs. And the thing I remember most was this spiral staircase going into nowhere, because it was just the one floor and you couldn't see the ceiling, obviously, on TV. And that just really hit me as like a sort of weird kind of wonderful sort of fake world that he lived in.
Amazing. Usually in the interviews that I've been listening to of yourself in my research, it begins with you talking about your writing when you first met Jesse. But I'd be interested to go back a little bit and find out if perhaps maybe in your earlier years, there was any kind of inklings to storytelling or passion for writing.
I guess I did a little bit of writing or making stuff up as a kid. But when I started writing properly was in my second year at university in Manchester, which is this creative writing class I started where I did meet Jesse. And that was a big deal because it was like an organized attempt at writing fiction. It was short stories and poetry. I have no recollection of any poems I wrote, which is probably for the best. But short stories I definitely embraced as like a really great format, try things out. And I guess I would say that I do really believe in creative writing classes in general. And I always think that they're worth doing. I think there's a couple of myths. One is there's this phrase I think I've heard, like, you can't teach writing. And to some extent, that's true in the sense you can't give someone a talent they don't have. But the two critical things you get from a creative writing class are deadlines and feedback. And deadlines and feedback are what you deal with day in, day out in the industry, right? And especially in TV, more in a way than in publishing, because the feedback can be quite relentless and the deadlines can be quite relentless in TV particularly. And just having that kind of, and they're both quite hard work, right? They're both quite difficult. Deadlines, famously hard. Feedback, getting notes, criticism, famously difficult. So getting used to that from an early age, from really the first short story I wrote in like 1991 was really, really important to kind of to build those muscles of dealing with deadlines and feedback.
Yeah, Seth Godin talks about it. He says, you've got to be professional. Even if you're not getting paid, if you're going to have one of these sort of careers, you've got to be like, right, I am treating this seriously. I'm going to get every Monday morning, it's going to be my writing time, that sort of thing. And you've got to build that muscle, as you say.
Yeah, exactly. And also in a creative writing class, you're with other people. And that's amazingly important because I think there's also a little bit of a myth about writing that you should sort of be able to figure it all out on your own, right? That you kind of just go away and you're a genius and you come back with a perfect screenplay. And that has never been my experience. I've never written anything like that on my own. You know, I'm always going to send it to someone, whether it's a co-writer or a producer or a director. The more I can feel connected to other people, even when I'm spending a lot of time on my own writing, which obviously is a big part of my work, you know, I always want to feel connected. I never get anything done if I feel I'm completely isolated, not in 32 years of writing. So I think that young writers feel like they should be able to crack it all on their own, I would just say that's not my experience and you don't need to think that way.
Speaking of connection, what was it about yourself and Jesse in that class that connected? Was there perhaps other people that, you know, could have been your partner, or was it you guys from the start?
No, I don't think there were any other Jessies around. To be honest, we just became good friends and he obviously was a talented writer, but we were very early on in our career, so we weren't writing like polished, perfect stories or anything. We ended up sharing a flat together for our final year there and just became great friends. And I suppose one thing naturally led to another. When we thought about writing, it was years after we left university, when we thought about writing for TV, we obviously knew there were lots of comedy writing partnerships in sitcom history, especially in the UK. Mm. And it was a natural thing to try, but the friendship came first. And I think that probably, you know, was a really nice thing.
And the first, as I mentioned in the intro, few jobs that you guys worked on together, you did a lot of kids TV, which is an interesting place to start. Often writers such as myself, you look at people's storied careers and you don't necessarily look all the way back to where it starts. And it's interesting to see that on yours. Were there any lessons that you've taken from those Tracy Beaker type days into your later career?
It was a really great place to start for a couple of reasons. Firstly, at that time, end of the 90s, 2000, which is when we were doing it, there weren't really any that I knew of team-written sitcoms. I think My Family came out shortly after that, and that was one of the first. But to be on a team as a younger writer is the standard thing in the US, but it wasn't in the UK at that time. And that's really where you learn, where you're taught how do you create a half hour episode? How do you create a series? I think it's an illusion to feel like you should be able to go in at the top straight away. I'm going to write a pilot, write a series, be a genius. Again, you know, you need to practice. And also, Kids TV is kind of wonderful in the sense that it's under the radar. No one's going to give you a horrendous review, you know, in the national press for your episode of a kids show, because they just don't bother, right? Either they don't review it or it's a friendly recommendation or whatever. So again, you fit somewhere you can sort of incubate your abilities in a sort of safe space. And also, I think writing for kids in general, it forces you to think visually, right? You're not going to want to do lots of scenes with endless monologues and sort of long speeches. And writing visually is a key skill that differentiates screenwriting from, say, prose or poetry or theatre, you know, coming up with arresting visual images or thinking always about what's on screen. That's a really good training.
Yeah, I've seen you say before about how the top peep show joke list, it's usually the visual gags, the ones that seem to have that staying power even.
Yeah, in comedy, I think a visual gag, you know, beats a verbal one every time if you can think of a good one.
Yeah. Speaking of Peep Show, I'm interested in the early days of it and, you know, speaking for writers and seeing the difficulties of getting things made. It was a bit of a bizarre process, wasn't it? Because it got that 15-minute pilot made. And I'd love to know what was going through your time, your head at this time, Sam, because I guess it didn't necessarily show a huge belief that this show was definitely going to get made. It was going to go onto all those series. How did you feel at that time?
Yeah, so the 15-minute, we did two 15-minute pilots, which ended up being two halves of what became episode two of the first series. And that is a very strange way to write a show, because we literally didn't have... When we had the second 15-minute pilot commissioned, we didn't know what was going to happen. And we literally made the rest of the episode up after we got it commissioned, which is, again, not the way you do it normally.
Yeah.
Anyway, it kind of worked out, obviously, but... I don't think we ever felt like pissed off that they weren't commissioning the whole pilot, because frankly, we'd been around, you know, a while, and you know, you've probably very generous, nice way glossed over a couple of massive flops that me and Jesse had before Peep Show. After the kids stuff, we did two series which died hard. Days Like These, which was an ITV adaptation of a very popular American sitcom called That 70s Show, and Ed Stone Is Dead, which was an abortive attempt of a sitcom with Richard Blackwood on BBC Three. And those really flopped hard. They were like disastrous. And that really helped us, actually.
Oh, really?
Because, because like, look, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, to quote Friedrich Nietzsche, the famous screenwriting guru. And, you know, we understood very clearly at that point that things could go wrong very easily, and that we could take nothing for granted. And it made us focus harder on things that we felt like were going to have a good chance of success. So we sort of put everything we had into Peep Show. We didn't want to have three flops in a row. And we also understood that, you know, Channel 4 were naturally cautious. It was quite a weird idea, weird concept with the POV and the voiceovers. It wasn't like a guaranteed, you know, hit. So I think we understood their point of view. Let's see if it works. We didn't know if it would work.
Yeah. Speaking of the voiceovers, which obviously became the most famous part of it in many ways and what differentiates it from so many other things, was there ever, between yourself and Jesse, obviously you were writing the episodes together, did one of you have maybe more of an allegiance or find it easier to write one of the two voices over the other? Perhaps one of you was easier at Mark or the other way around?
I don't think so. No, not really. I mean, look, in a way, with those two characters, we consciously created archetypes in the sense of, here's an anxious introvert, here's a arrogant extrovert, in very broad terms. And we just felt like you need two very different points of view for your two main characters, obviously. And also, I think it's always a good, as I said, team writing is the norm in the States and more so in the UK now. And it's always a test, I think, of a good character that other people could come in and write them, right, on your writing team or between two writers, because that sort of proves that they kind of have a reality, they have a lived-in feel. So you, what you don't want to do really is create a character that only one person can write, because then that's probably going to be quite hard. So we very much kind of saw them as shared vehicles. Yeah.
And for the listeners and a few of my friends who I told I was going to be interviewing you, one of the things that people, I think, have, you know, difficulty understanding what's the balance, how does it work, is between yourself and Mitchell and Webb, when it says additional material, what does that mean? Could you tell the listeners how that kind of works?
Yeah, I is that on every series? I can't remember that credit, whether it went away or not. I don't remember. Look, I mean, credits, yeah, they very rarely tell a full story. It's always interesting to find out. I think with additional material, we wanted to reflect the fact that obviously those two guys were critical parts of not only the series, obviously, but the writing process. I mean, that credit normally you think of as someone punching up scripts, I guess. And that they definitely didn't do that and wouldn't have wanted to. And they didn't really improvise at all. But what they did do, the first thing we ever did when a series started, was me and Jesse would come up with a bunch of ideas, quite general ideas. And then the next thing we would do would sit down with them, usually over a nice pub lunch.
Is this the Peep Show plot parties by any chance?
Correct. Very good research. Peep Show plot party. And we would sort of pitch them ideas, look at their faces, see if they looked like they were smiling or horrified. And then we would just, you know, brainstorm and bounce around. And I think that, you know, they just always had a very clear handle on their characters. And obviously they're brilliant comic minds, amazing comedy writers in their own right. We actually met them as writers. You know, we met them on a writing, a sort of BBC comedy writing project. So we always saw them as writers first, funnily enough. We didn't know they were such funny actors until later. And so we always, always, always wanted their point of view and their input. So it's hard to put an exact definition on what they contributed, apart from the fact they contributed a lot in every series.
Fantastic. And one of the things that I couldn't forgive myself if I didn't ask about today is Four Lions. A little story for you is when I was about 15, I think it came out, and friends of mine went to Tesco, Orpington High Street in Southeast London, and we were picking up all the DVD boxes as you did back then. And I remember on the back, it just said funny like 100 times. And that was the only review from everyone. And we went with it and had one of the best DVD experiences ever. So I'd love to ask about that. And Chris Morris is obviously quite famously a bit fearless. I'd cite the paedophile episode of Brass Eye. But did yourself personally feel much trepidation getting into what I guess you would call terrorism comedy? I don't know how you would call it, Sam.
Yeah, you could call it that. Yeah, the funny thing was Chris. That was very much Chris. He just picked that word out. And it was a clever thing to do, pick that one word out of all these reviews so that the poster was just... And he just understood that, you know, that is a relatively rare thing, a genuinely funny film, which I think Four Lions is. And so people were going to want to watch a funny film, and the rest is kind of like, we'll see what happens. Yeah, fearless he is. I think that what I also really respect about Chris is that he has a very sort of an artist's approach to comedy. And what I mean by that is that when we first started talking to him about Four Lions, he didn't know if it was going to work. It was almost like he didn't like, right, I'm going to do this film in a year's time. And I want to, you know, it was just more of a very, what we never had experienced before, because people have obviously a very career orientated, business-like approach to writing and filmmaking. I wouldn't call him unbusiness-like, but it was just more sort of, let's just sit down and sort of pose ourselves the question, could you make a comedy about this subject? We don't know. Let's see if we can come up with an answer or not. And I really appreciated that open-ended approach, because it also, it's not arrogant. It's not saying, I'm Chris Morris, I'm a comedy genius, I know how to make the subject funny. It wasn't like that at all. It was like, let's just sort of put it in the comedy lab and see what comes out.
Did you do much research for it?
Chris did all the research, and that again made it much easier on us, because he did a lot of research, met a lot of people, really got into the subject, which was great for us because we didn't have to do that. And also me and Jesse had a much more clearer role of like, okay, we're gonna really focus on the story, characters. We're almost gonna purposefully not do any research. And I read like one or two books and watched a couple of things, nothing major. Because the danger of research is you can drown in it, and you can have so many perspectives and ideas and stories that you lose perspective on what the film requires to tell a story in 90 minutes. So we were always like, that's our job, to make sure we tell a good story in 90 minutes and not get lost in the weeds, you know.
Now, you've moved recently to LA to write movies, which is obviously a new, you know, one of the same and different again. How did you feel when you first arrived? Did you feel the confidence of carrying your British success over with you, or was there a nervousness to it as well, or both?
Yeah, I mean, the move, you know, it's a lot the same and a lot more different than I expected in lots of different ways. But I was very lucky because I didn't really know how well respected and well seen Peep Show and Fresh Meat and Four Lions, but Peep Show probably first and foremost, how well known it was here in the industry. So that really helped. But yeah, writing films, writing in America, writing solo, all three of those things have been learning curves because they're quite different to what I was doing in the UK in ways that I didn't really understand or expect. And the industry is obviously much bigger and much different. But it's still the same, you know, sort of practice, as it were, sitting at your desk trying to figure things out.
How do Hollywood backlot meetings compare to Channel 4 offices?
I mean, it's my answer would be very different on that 3 years ago, because COVID and Zoom have changed so much. You know, we're obviously talking on Zoom. I sometimes feel like I live my life on Zoom. You know, the most recent writer's room I've done was on Zoom. I did a bunch of pitch meetings just before the strike. Half of them were in person, half of them were on Zoom, you know, even though they were possibly down the road, you know. So that's a mixed blessing, but I would say it's enabled people, you know, like yourself who are UK based, you don't, you know, moving here like I did feels a little bit old fashioned in a sense, because in those days, you know, all the meetings would be in person, and that's just not the case anymore. So I think we're still feeling the effects of all that change, but I think it benefits people who don't necessarily want to or are able to move to Los Angeles for their writing career.
Interesting. Is it more liberating a little bit maybe to suddenly be able to write these more expansive worlds of your own making in these movies, as opposed to maybe the smaller sitcom-y world that you're in before in The Flat, for example? I'd use maybe Corporate Animals as an example, out in the desert.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways it's liberating. I mean, look, comedy movies are possibly, you know, I've written a bunch of different things, novels, plays, TV, film, radio. I'd say comedy movies in some ways are the hardest, because you're trying to do a complete story with a character development from beginning to end, and be funny and be dramatic. And also, films have become less and less easy to get made compared to TV. So all those things are kind of working against you. But I still really love writing movies, and I still really love movies in general. I've always been a movie buff. I think that TV is clearly kind of like premier gateway for drama and comedy now, in the way that it wasn't in the past. But there's something about a complete story and learning to do that, and learning the skills from that, which still really excites me to figure that out, because I'm still learning, you know. I probably always will be.
Do you find that there is a different attitude at all in the writing of the comedy? Because I guess traditionally there was maybe more of a divide between the quote-unquote British versus American comedy, whereas that's been eroded over the last few years with things like Your Friend Armando and things like that, with Veep, writing for American characters, I guess, predominantly now for yourself, rather than maybe British sitcom.
Yeah, I think that British and American comedy is closer than ever. And lots of Brits working here and Americans working there, as I'm sure you know, so many things are now shot in the UK that are American or even without a British setting. So I think the two industries have become closer and closer, even in the last few years.
Amazing. Now, before we wrap up on Red Carpet Rookies, Sam, I just want to ask one question before I do my quick fire. I'd love to ask, this is a personal one. I've always got one personal one. Could you explain for the listeners where Superhands came from?
Superhands, what, the name or the character or
the,
both?
The character, really. Or both, I guess.
Well, look, in some ways, you could call Peep Show something of an homage to With None and I, which is a film I'm sure you've seen. Mm. And you could sort of draw a comparison between Paul McGann with Nail and Danny the drug dealer with Mark Jeremy and Superhands. We always liked that kind of character, a sort of extreme, unpredictable character who you could write some very different stuff for. I think we actually had Danny Dyer in mind when we wrote it. We were big fans of his from Human yeah, Traffic. Yeah, he auditioned for it, I believe. Russell Brand certainly did. But we also wanted a different voice, as Mark and Jeremy wanted a different angle. And originally, for some obscure reason, we thought it'd be funny if he was Dutch. I think we find the Dutch accents funny, so apologies to any Dutch people who are listening who might find that to be offensive. But yeah, we just like this guy who is called Hans and who was kind of in love with himself and gave himself the nickname Super Hans. And when we changed him, obviously he's not Dutch anymore, although there are some weird German connections to his history, which I don't fully understand myself. Anyway, we thought the name was so weird and funny, we kept it. I think I always remember David and Robert admiring our courage in giving one of our main characters such a stupid name. I think they thought that was commitment to the cause. So I take that as a badge of honor.
Amazing. Thank you so much for humoring me with that one. Now, yes, to wrap up on Red Carpet Rookies, I do a little quickfire, Sam, which is my own ode to In the Actor's Studio. So if you could think of what comes into your head, that would be amazing. The first one is, what is one of the best pieces of advice you've ever been given?
Don't get it right, get it written, is an old saying about writing. I don't know who said it, but I think about it all the time because it's very easy when you're writing to think, oh, this must be better, this must be perfect. It's like, no, just get it on the page.
Lovely. Number two, do you have a favorite film or maybe just one that impacted you a lot?
I'm going to say Taxi Driver because it's my favorite film and it impacted me a lot. And it's surprisingly funny for those who haven't seen it recently. There's some great comedy in that.
Yeah. Number three, which job in the industry would you do if you weren't doing yours?
I mean, the obvious answer is directing, because I think that's something I'd like to do at some point. But I'm going to say editing, because I think editors get a lot of, they don't get enough credit, and they're incredible storytellers. And I like the idea of a job where I can also sit down all day.
Fantastic. Number four, this one's a killer. If you could work with one person, living or dead, who would it be? Sorry.
I mean, Marlon Brando, he's a good actor.
Yep, he is a good actor, definitely. Number five, what is a book that everyone should read? Could be career focused, if that makes it any easier.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of writing, I would always recommend Adventures in the Screen Trade by William Goldman. I must have read that book four times. It's so much fun, and the sequel's just as good. And it's also a very, very helpful writing manual.
And finally, if you won an Oscar, who would you thank?
I'd have to thank Jesse, really. I don't think I'd have any kind of career like I've got without him. So I'm going to leave it with that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time today, Sam. Humoury with my Peep Show questions. And yeah, this is very special for me. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, my pleasure. It's fun, Mike. I hope it was useful.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Red Carpet Rookies. To help us grow and be able to interview more amazing film and TV professionals, please do subscribe and drop us a rating on the Apple Podcast Store on your iPhone or online if you're an Android user. If you're interested in regular updates, the best thing you can do is to join our mailing list at redcarpetrookies.com or alternatively, find us on Instagram at redcarpetrookies or Twitter at rcrookiespod. I also tweet regularly about my own learnings in the business at Mike F. Battle on Twitter, so please do come and say hi. Thank you again for listening. We'll see you next time.